Hi, everyone. Before we get to our interview today, which is with David L. Bahnsen speaking about his book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, let me mention to you that our early bird rate for our Reform Forum annual theology conference will be ending in just a few days. If you're listening to this episode or watching it right when it comes out, which it's scheduled for August 29th, 2025, the early bird rate will end on September 1st, I believe, or at the end of it. It's coming up very, very soon. So the early bird rate is still in effect. Please register now and secure your savings. Our conference theme is the things concerning himself, Christ, in all the scriptures. That comes from Luke 24. Our conference is going to be September 27th, 2025. Lane Tipton, Jim Cassidy, Carlton Wynn, Dan Ragusa, and myself will be speaking on different aspects of that phrase in Luke 24 and considering Christ as revealed in all scripture. Standard registration is only $60, and that includes a lunch. All access is available, $110. You not only get to come to the full sessions on Saturday with a lunch, but that'll get you access to our pre-conference event, which is going to be amazing. It's going to be hosted at Primo Italian American Cuisine on Friday, September 26th. You're going to want to come. Come visit us. The event's held at Lakeland Church in Gurnee, Illinois, not too far from O'Hare. It's easy to get here. We'd love to have you. Again, register now, secure your savings. We'd love to have you. Prices are going to increase very soon. So get going. Register now. Now to the episode. Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois at the Reformed Forum headquarters, as usual. And I'm delighted to be back today with a very special podcast. We've got some excellent new guests, and I'm really excited to speak about a wonderful new book. Let me introduce you first. We have our panelist, Mark Van Drunen. Mark serves on the Reformed Forum Board of Directors here. He also works in finance, and he's a ruling elder at Redeemer PCA in Hudson, Ohio. Welcome, Mark. It's good to have you on the podcast, not just listening from home.
Glad to be back.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you, and thank you also for having me over. I was just at a conference in Cleveland, stayed with Mark on Saturday night, and was able to go worship at Redeemer on Sunday morning. Had a wonderful time there with the saints. Thank you for that, brother. And thank you also for joining me, because you're going to bring some expertise as we speak with our very special guest. Today, we're welcoming David L. Bahnsen, who's the founder, managing partner, and chief investment officer of the Bahnsen Group. It's a private wealth management firm. He's also the author of Crisis of Responsibility, Our Cultural Addiction to Blame and How You Can Cure It, The Case for Dividend Growth, Investing in a Post-Crisis World, as well as a new book, Full Time, Working and the Meaning of Life. David, welcome. It's wonderful to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
Yes, we were speaking just ahead of time, and for people who don't know, they ought to, but if they haven't connected the dots, David is the son of Greg Bahnsen, Dr. Greg Bahnsen, who is a wonderful, just esteemed figure in Reformed theology. I owe so much to him. I'm thankful for the way the Lord used him throughout his life, and he was instrumental through his book, Van Til's Apologetic, to get me into ministry and off to Westminster Theological Seminary and on the Reformed and Vantillian trajectory that I'm on. It's everything we do here at Reformed Forum is Vantillian and Vossian, and Dr. Bahnsen has much to do with that. And I know the same is true for the life of Lane Tipton, who actually did a lot of correspondence courses over the phone with your father, David, and it's exciting. So it's wonderful to see you here, and we're going to be speaking a bit theologically about this book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, as well as speaking about economics, work in general, and the image of God. I'm very excited to talk about this. This is a biblically grounded, theologically reflective, and a culturally engaged exploration on the meaning of work. I want to ask you right away, Mark, just as we start, just how you were introduced to David's work, but specifically this book, and why you're so excited that we talk about it today as we get going.
Well, this past year, I read the book twice, once by myself, and I said, this is fantastic. So what I plan to do, it was a unique summer in the fact that my wife hosted a Bible study with a bunch of friends, and I was able to steal away my son and my son-in-law and my future-to-be son-in-law, and we read the book and then golfed every Tuesday. And as we walk through this, It really helped reset their view as they are now entering into the workforce on the purpose behind work. And it was such a joy to have those discussions around the table. And then out on the golf course, we even brought in a special guest, a pastor who also read it. And David, I want to thank you for this book. And maybe your first question is, for somebody who's just starting their career, somebody who's graduating from high school, who's going to start in the trades, or somebody who's just finished their 4 years and is getting ready to work in finance or another field, what's your encouragement to them to have a Christian worldview in how they work?
Well, my encouragement to folks about having a Christian worldview in how they work is even broader than those that are coming into finance. I have a particular interest in seeing more people entering finance that possess a Christian worldview and implement and utilize their worldview in the way that they execute in their profession. But theologically, my passion is for all people to bring the worldview toolbox to their vocation, no matter what field it's in. And that's one of the delights about being a Kuiperian. Every square inch means every square inch. And I don't do carve-outs. And I think a lot of people do carve-outs for finance or carve-outs for politics or carve-outs for certain areas. So I feel strongly about it in the world of wealth advisory, and it's probably the area which I know the most about. But theologically, I'd apply the same commitment to technology and agriculture and various other domains of entrepreneurial activity as well. And I wanted to say just real quick, as we get ready to talk about this book, you notice this book that I've written that we're here to talk about today is dedicated to my late father. And Camden mentioned my late father's book on Van Til, which came out posthumously for my dad, was dedicated to me, unbeknownst to me until after dad passed and the book was published. I found out that he had published it to me. So we have a nice little reference in just the first 5 minutes of the podcast here to two books written by these two Bonsons that both dedicated books to one another.
Well, praise the Lord for that. That's a wonderful, wonderful heritage that you have. And, we're thankful for that and thankful for your being here speaking with us. And I just resonated so much with the book and knowing, and you even mentioned Kuiper. I was going to ask you maybe a question on that later, but you already got to it. Just how much the book is beneficial and compliant, you know, with the themes that we find in our rich theological tradition. So people are going to love this. And I love this intersection of business and theology, and it's just a healthy way to think with a Christian worldview. We shouldn't be dividing up our thinking, saying, well, this is my Christian sphere of life, and now I have this other department of life where I deal with finance and those sorts of things. It's a holistic world and life view. And along those lines, you argue that work is not a curse. Sometimes people might think that work itself is a function of the curse. Work's affected by the curse, of course, but you argue that work itself is not a curse, but it's part of God's original design. What do you think? How do you think, you know, maybe rediscovering that truth can be a corrective for Christians today? How might it reshape the way that Christians think about their daily jobs, for example?
Well, as you know from the book itself, I think it's not only a corrective, but the corrective, because I structured the book's argument around Genesis chapter 1. And I believe that a rediscovery of creational theology is incredibly important for the way we understand much of our own kingdom living. The distinct Reformed heritage around a robust view of work is rooted to being decidedly anti-dualistic. So sacred-secular distinction was put aside by the Reformers. And that ought to have a profound impact and ought to be foundational in how we view our work. I'm more sympathetic to people who have a lower view of work if they enter the consideration with the belief, which I believe to be errant, but if their premise is that the work itself represents something subordinate to other superior elements of the kingdom, that it represents something subordinate or even second class, second or third tier in terms of prioritization, relative to ministry or relative to various elements of heavenly mindedness. My view is that work is heavenly minded. My view is that heaven represents the restoration of Edenic conditions. We find ourselves after the fall in need of a redeemer, and that redeemer is restoring us to these conditions and this Emmanuel principle. And I look forward to God being with us in the new heavens and new earth, and I look forward to the work we will do in that time. But that along the way, the work we are doing is part of our created design, not part of our sinful nature.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I'll ante up and take you one further. I think it's not merely just a restoration to Eden, but even obviously a glorified surpassing of it in the new heavens and the new earth. But yeah, what the promise held out for Adam in the garden was certainly one of a higher, more glorious life in the new heavens and the new earth. He forfeited that, of course, in the covenant of works, but Jesus Christ secures it for us in the covenant of grace. But some people might misunderstand that and think, well, when we get to heaven, no more work. It's all over, right? It's almost akin to that the plague of the certain type of retirement thinking we have. Mark, I know you've got a little question on that. We might as well ask, because I loved hearing your little story about your father and your thoughts on heaven back when you were younger.
Oh, yeah, I was when Camden was over, we were sitting around the campfire. We were talking about how I was, I think, 6 years old in the back of a gray station wagon. My dad was filling up. It was about 8:30 at night, dusk. And my dad sees me crying in the back seat. And he's like, why are you crying? Like, we're on vacation. And I said, well, I don't know if I really want to go to heaven. You know, in the mind of a six-year-old was, you're going to sit in a hardwood bench and go to church all day, or sit on a cloud and play a harp. Neither of those were very appealing. Yeah. And the question I really wanted to get to with you was, what are we going to be doing in heaven if it's not that? We're going to be worshiping God. And I think you get to it, but I'd love to hear you explore what you think we'll be doing in heaven.
Well, you know, Mark, it's funny because I don't think that your story is totally anecdotal. I think that an awful lot of Christians, dare I say, perhaps the majority of Christians who at least found faith as children would have some similar story, because it's almost unavoidable with the church's teaching, intentional or not, that imagery is formed and impressions are kind of embedded into our undeveloped brains of exactly what you're talking about regarding heaven, a place in which we're sort of in an eternal worship that even if we shouldn't think of it as a chore, it seems disconnected from a normal life. And part of it is understandable in the sense that we have only known a sinful world, and it is somewhat difficult to fantasize about life without sin. Right? But the problem is our theological daydreaming should not be to fantasize about not having any kind of life. It should be about not having the sin. What does it mean to go build and do and grow when there isn't sin? I admit it's kind of difficult to do when we have our own time and space limitations. But the notion of heaven as a place in which this activity ceases is not in the Bible. And to the extent one has an understanding of new heavens and new earth as a fulfillment and surpassing, as Camden just said, of the Edenic conditions and that restoration of Emmanuel principle, I think we're going to be more busy and productive than ever. Now, to the extent one will say, talk about Hebrews and heavenly rest, and there is a certain worshipful component. There's no intent here in what I'm saying to contradict any of that, but rather to fill it in. And as you know, I dedicate a fair amount of space in chapter 3 of my book to the fact that the word avodah, from which we get a lot of our understanding of worship and where we will be one day worshiping in this context, is the same Hebrew word for work. And that the fourth commandment itself, lest there be any question about context, utilizes avodah. Is 6 days shalt thou work, and then the seventh is day of rest. This is a very clear grammatical distinction between, our vocational work and rest. Otherwise, the fourth commandment becomes sort of incoherent. And that word is literally translated as worship and as work. And so I see that confluence of work and worship is a majestic idea theologically and should give six-year-olds and 60-year-olds a lot of excitement for our eternal destiny.
Well, I really appreciate that response because like yourself, I was introduced to Bob Buford, Halftime, Lloyd Reeb, Success Through Significance. And in many ways, they do wonderful work. However, I think the premise by which they wrote those books or in direct, I think you have a more robust theological answer to why we work and the purpose behind it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we certainly see, just to follow up with that, David, just to even continue to building that case, Isaiah 65 depicts the new heavens and the new earth, and the prophet there is speaking very clearly about each person having his or her own fig tree. And the promise is not that we cease working, but that we enjoy the full benefits and blessings of our labor, that there's a full, almost, you know, an actualized productivity, so to speak, not in the sense of, you know, tips and tricks for how to use your computer better, but in terms of you work and you receive all the benefits from the blessing of that work, whereas the curses of the covenant are often you work and someone else takes, you know, what you did. It's the opposite of those curses. We see that throughout the Bible. That's a promise of the future. Mark alluded to it a little bit, but David, I'd love if you maybe unpack the title for those who might not know where the title comes from. So to the extent that you'd like to, I'd wonder if you might explain full time and maybe the premise of the book. You get to it later in the book, interestingly, but there's a whole chapter on this, but I think it sets the stage really well.
At full time, it was inspired by my wife and I on a lengthy walk one day, as we are known to do. My wife and I do a lot of long walks together, and mm-hmm. she's a very creative type, and it kind of came up and ran with it. But what I thought was particularly useful was this sort of double entendre, and that if there had never been a book written by Buford called Halftime, I still actually like the title Full Time anyways, in terms of describing a mentality that I was aspiring to in the book of workers that need not be ashamed. There's a sort of full time component to this that doesn't view work as a burden, a chore to minimize and get away from. And so I like that, even for those who weren't familiar with the obvious reactionary context, which was to Buford's Halftime book. So Bob Buford wrote a book called Halftime that ended up now selling over 1 million copies. And I suspect hundreds of thousands of those have been in bulk sales to churches that have used it in men's Bible studies, in Sunday school classes and things like that. Nearly everybody I've ever talked to that read Halftime didn't go on their own to a bookstore and buy it or pick it up on Amazon on their own. It's been part of a church study. And so it's really been sort of bulk sailed and institutionalized in that capacity. I'm hopeful that those who read chapter 9 of the book and my treatment of this concept will feel that I was successful in being charitable and gracious in my critique, because I really tried hard to be. But I am vigilantly critical of the mentality and of the implications that I think have flowed from it, which mostly, in my estimation, having been around it and studied it for a very long time now, have served to give middle-aged men a guilt complex about what they've done in the first half of their life that they can then atone for by pivoting to something different in the second half of their life. And it's a latent, not an explicit, but a latent dualism that I find very problematic. And in the book, I attempt to explain that the notion of halftime moving from success to significance inevitably implies that our success and our significance are at odds with one another, where in fact the things that we are doing to be quote-unquote successful, these career things he's talking about, the things in the first half of our life when we're out, you know, lo and behold, paying off our houses and getting ready to put our kids through college, that those things then need to be transitioned into something significant is inaccurate, when in fact, in God's eyes, the things we're doing, presumably, if they're good enough to help us pay off our houses and put our kids through college and sustain our families, we must be pretty good at them. Those are the things that, in fact, are our significance. And I want to put down this notion of middle-aged men having to feel like what they spent much of their life doing was not relevant in the kingdom of God, because I think it was very relevant.
Yeah, I really resonated with and appreciated that critique. And you speak not just in that chapter, but throughout the book, criticizing this tendency that real ministry happens in the church. Now, there's a sense in which, you know, if we're speaking of ordained ministry or specific things, that's true. But this idea that if I want to be serious about my faith and do something that matters, I need to somehow, you know, exit the world and then enter some sort of ecclesiastical role. That's a problem that I encountered in evangelical groups and churches when I was in college. And it's like, it's really just the same hangover as asceticism, or this idea of, you know, how the monastic, you know, tradition began, and that's what serious Christians are supposed to do. And it's terrible. And then we're thankful for the Protestant work ethic and a Reformed understanding of vocation. But to pick back up with what you just mentioned, David, you certainly critique the modern tendency to see work as only about making money or achieving status. But working hard and making money and achieving status, or at least recognition for doing good work, those aren't bad things either. Could you comment on that and speak to that and maybe help people not feel bad about doing a good job?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot in there, because not only would I argue that they're not bad things, the scripture actually tells me that they're good things. And there's some verses that don't make a lot of sense if that isn't true. When we are told that those who do their work well will be highly regarded before men and will receive the respect of kings and rulers, you know, there's a certain status, not from some sort of worldly elite exposure, but because of meritocracy. You know, it is the scriptures connecting that in doing your work well, you'll be recognized and gain and influence and prestige and respect, and that is a good thing. And I think that what a lot of believers have done is attach something that I think is maybe well intentioned, but a little overly pietistic for my liking, to say that when you're working for the praise of others, you know, it can be problematic. And there's a sense in which that's very true if you're merely working for the praise of others. But if you're fundamentally working to play out your calling as an image bearer of God, and in so doing, you are living a fulfilling life, you're living the good life that God intends for you to be, a person who's obedient and faithful, and you find joy in those things, you find peace in those things, that there's a pro-cyclical, you know, there's a virtuous cycle to it that I think is very blessed. But then the byproduct of that being greater influence and greater recognition, it doesn't have to be the underlying objective. It's the consequence that Scripture itself predicted. And so I think we tie ourselves in knots trying to avoid this basic reality that what you ought to be doing is work to the best of your ability. Unashamed worker, doing your work heartily is for the Lord. And you're not doing it for men, which is the second part of that Colossians 3:23 passage. But in the fact that you gain respect from others, this is a good thing when people get it for the right reasons.
No, I think that's really helpful, because in the group that I led this summer with these young men, was this idea of the secular sacred divide. And I think that was something new to these young men, and they probably couldn't articulate it, but they sensed that. And there was a false guilt. Our pastor, Scott Wright, talks about the number one problem with Christians today is this sense of false guilt about some of these things. Yeah. And you speak in the book about the role that we have in society. And when we do a good job, we are giving glory to God and testifying of his goodness and his truth and his beauty. And I think that's something very powerful, and that we shouldn't negate our role in our community when we do that. When I do a good job and help somebody achieve their financial goals, as you do, that is meaningful for that family.
It's meaningful for that family, and then it becomes meaningful for your family. And this is the area where it's very difficult to actually properly theologically understand these things if we are trying to put up a wall of separation between the theology and economics. This is sort of the underlying reason that I make a theological argument for a market economy, for a free enterprise system, that we fundamentally drive service of others, in so doing benefit ourselves, and by keeping in mind that all systems are tainted by sin on this side of the fall, that what we're describing is the best system we have for our work to all at once meet our needs and yet provide us incentive to vigorously serve our fellow mankind through the production of goods and services. This is a very pro-growth thing I've said. And that it would be attached to a system of free market economics does not mean I'm trying to secularize the message. I'm trying to point out that the actual message of a market economy is not itself secular, but rooted to what we understand in biblical anthropology.
Allowing people to flourish. This is a good thing, not a bad thing.
That's right.
And I really appreciated how you built upon the late Dr. Keller's book, Every Good Endeavor. That from that basis, I see this as a opportunity to build upon the viewpoint on our work and having an impact for our community.
Yeah. I'd love if you could speak more about these basic economic principles. If people are interested, you can go back to an episode we had with an economist, Sean Rittenour from Grove City College. And he thinks long and hard about a lot of these things and the intersection between economics and theology. I love it. But just you comment on the relationship and maybe the imbalance. It's maybe not the best word here, but between production and consumption. We live so much in a culture that just prioritizes and emphasizes consumption. But if we start there and we think about the goal of work is just so that we can consume more, we've flipped everything on its head, certainly from a Christian perspective. I'd love if you could comment on that and explain that for people.
Yes, and I assure you that Dr. Rittenour and I see this the same way, and Sean is a fantastic economist and thinker, and I'm blessed to have shared a stage with him on different events and so forth, and we're quite like-minded on it. I think that the production versus consumption debate is one day going to resonate in a way much stronger than it has over the last 75 years, when we understand that it is truly a fundamentally theological question that gets to the very heart of what I refer to as anthropology, of what God made mankind for. And while it is largely used as a policy debate, in the second half of the 20th century and into these early decades of the 21st century, in what is referred to as so-called Keynesian economics, that we're talking about a lot of policy implications of an economic belief that we can really kind of create growth and juice the economy by stimulating aggregate demand, by effectively motivating people to consume more. And so guys like Sean Rittenour and myself have a lot of criticisms of that idea economically, but our criticism is rooted, unlike some of my supply side economic heroes who have the same opinion on this subject that Sean and I do. The formation of our opinion on this is rooted to what we understand from Scripture about the human person, that God made us as productive creatures because we're made in His image. And that what I know about the reason and rational faculties of mankind as created by God is that mankind is very rarely in need of incentive to consume. We just seem to have a really good awareness of our appetites and taste and whatnot. And consumption comes quite easily. But that understanding that our productive capacity gives birth to our ability to consume, and understanding that there is nothing to consume that hasn't first been produced. So we have two choices here. We can limit our consumption to what we produce, and we can survive that way. But maybe. Mark used the term flourishing a moment ago. Mankind's capacity for human flourishing grows a great deal with the division of labor of God's creation. And our ability to consume what other people in mankind have produced makes for a far more interesting world. And it makes for the world God designed and for the building of civilization as He intended out of the Garden of Eden when He asked mankind to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. This was a commandment for production. And so the commandment of production is the first step. The sequence is so important because it's a sine qua non. You can't have consumption without having production. And so there's a lot of policy ramifications I'm getting to, but then they really can only be defended with this sort of theological understanding.
David, maybe it'd be helpful to give a little bit more of a background between supply and demand here, just because a lot of people maybe only had a intro to macro and microeconomics to really tease this out a little bit to understand when you say supply side, maybe they've heard of the Laffer curve or supply side economics from the Reagan era. Put a little bit of meat on that bone.
Well, I guess I'm arguing that the evolution of supply-side economics is first in Genesis 1 at creation, and these great supply-side economists named Adam and Eve. And then thousands of years later, we do get to a classical economic foundation well before the Reagan Revolution and the 20th century, where people like Adam Smith and especially John Baptiste Say taught us that production has to precede consumption. And then into the 20th century became a policy debate because a very famous secular economist named John Maynard Keynes talked about the escape from depressions, the escape from cyclical economic challenges being where we can use the policy tools of government to stimulate aggregate demand so that when mankind is feeling pessimistic about things and when wages and jobs have dropped, to avoid them consuming less, causing more wages and jobs to drop, that we would utilize government spending to try to make us want to go to the mall more. And somehow a very serious systematic policy effort evolved out of something quite so silly, where then what really gave birth to a lot of big policy victories in the Reagan years was the supply side movement, that all it really was rooted to the original classical economist that believed in a production first system that, again, I'm arguing was very much rooted to truths in scripture, that if we understand production as the real catalytic driver of economic growth, that when we are trying to create wealth, we want production to be more than consumption. And so when I teach economics to Christian high school students, I write up on the board W equals P minus C. Wealth equals production minus consumption. And say, you know, honestly, this isn't a very complicated formula, but if all you ever learn in economics 101, you call it macro, call it micro, but this is probably as important as anything you'll ever learn. And somehow we put it into our heads that wealth equaled consumption minus production, which of course leads to the irrationality of a negative number. If we're trying to consume more than can be produced, it's a silly concept. So I think that there are supply-demand interactions and economic, you know, theorems involved in this. But I don't think that any of that is ever disconnected from basic beliefs about the human person. And those beliefs for me are that God made us in his image, and that the image of God we have inherited because we do not share all attributes with God, that because we do not share his omnipotence, omnipresence, and omniscience, that when we focus on the part we do share, that's where we really fully appreciate and absorb the theology of being Imago Dei. And that what that means is the productive, creative, and innovative capacity that we have comes from our Heavenly Father. And out of that, we can co-create with him.
Yeah. This raises all sorts of interesting questions of anthropology, but there's also many questions in our present day about productivity and the rise of artificial intelligence and intelligent machines. And Mark, I know you've got a question on universal basic income. I wonder if you might prompt that. It seems like it would fit in well here at this point.
I remember, I think it was 2 weeks ago, it was a recent Wall Street Journal article, a weekend edition, where you had a lot of the titans of AI, those industrial leaders that were, they were advocating that universal basic income, UBI, needed to be the response of government because they anticipated this huge productivity boom and advancements. And, you know, some of us are experiencing those nascent stages of those productivity enhancements. But I think in their argument, they didn't realize that they're decoupling provision from productivity. And I think you really hit the nail on the head, even though you don't speak to it specifically, how that would undermine the dignity of work, how that would undermine how we were created as sub-creators under the ultimate creator. So my viewpoint is to say that would be devastating, be very inflationary. And you know, the experience that we've had for the last several years with modern money theory, the MMT, I think hopefully disavows people of trying to pursue that. But I would love for you to speak to that.
Well, I would be concerned to only root our critique of UBI to MMT or to any payment mechanism. You're right that they're often connected because many of the more serious proponents of UBI will say that the funding mechanism can be some form of MMT. But I really believe that we have to kill this root and branch. Yeah. In other words, if we came up with a way to pay for it with redistribution that wasn't deficit spending or money printing, I would still be
still
against
a problem.
It.
Yeah.
And so we have a problem here that goes beyond the affordability and goes into exactly what you said, which is the decoupling of provision and productivity and the dehumanizing element of that. If I believed that fundamentally work was a chore, a burden, and that only about 50% of us were really capable of doing it, and that because about 50% aren't, and work is really a curse, not a blessing, then I'd be very content to say, let's come up with an economic system where us blessed, capable people will do the work, and these unblessed, incapable people will get a good portion of the compensation, and they'll live happy, flourishing lives because of the sort of Marxian construct of work I just described, and we'll figure out the rest on our end, because at least we're a little bit more enlightened than the rest. Because my theology is that this work is a blessing, and that we were created for it, and that we find great joy, and this word dignity is very important because it becomes a real wonderful theological noun connected to Imago Dei. I think that the number one problem that I would start and end my critique of UBI with is that it is rooted to a willingness to decouple half of, 40% of, 20% of God's creation from something God created them for. Mm-hmm. And I find it unforgivable.
Yeah. You know, that also makes me think of another similar theme in contemporary culture. You hear an awful lot about following your passion.
Yeah.
And especially with young people, they're getting this advice, you know, don't get a stale job or just, you know, working in the office. You even have an example of someone who is, on all other marks, looked to be very qualified to be hired at your office, but had a question of work-life balance. And that meant, when can I get to the gym in the afternoon? The follow your passion thing is related. But often now we find that nobody wants any jobs except working as a YouTuber. So, I mean, how does this work and function? And I'm wondering what the thought is here in terms of finding fulfillment and working and living a meaningful life, laboring unto the Lord, but understanding that not everyone can do the same thing, and we're not necessarily called to live a life of entertainment. Entertainment and work are not necessarily the same things either.
Well, that's right. And I think that chapter in the book where I describe some real life stories, they weren't embellished for the sake of the book narrative. They do speak to a much wider, broader, more systemic dynamic right now at play. That the mentality is one in which we, I think, have maybe lost the plot a little bit. And then have defaulted, as human beings are very capable of doing successfully, to hide behind nomenclature or grammar, figures of speech to embed a certain decision that is problematic, but it can be very, very effective. It's not easy for one to come out taking a stance against work-life balance. You know, there's certain figures of speech out there that everybody just knows you're supposed to say you're against, or knows you're supposed to say you're for. And there's a real clever bait and switch going on because it can seem so innocuous. One of the other ones, this is anecdotal and not a subject of my book, but one of my biggest pet peeves is when Christians talk about philanthropy or anybody talks about philanthropy in the context of giving back. That you know, I left this town and I went out and I worked hard, built something, and I'm going back to the town I'm from, and I'm going to support that town. I'm going to give back, as if you stole from that town, or as if any charitable giving is giving back that you first took from others and now you're returning it. And the language seems innocuous, but I think it wouldn't be charitable if you were returning what you took. It would be restitution. Right. It only becomes charity at the point that you're giving, uh-huh. Not giving back. And I understand people think I'm playing a sort of semantics game here, but that's language that matters. And work-life balance is language that matters. Because if work is a vital part of your life, then work and life are not in tension and therefore not in need of being balanced. Now, if what one means, which is a very reasonable thing to say, is how do I manage my time and priorities to include more than one priority? And work is one of them, but so is family, and so are children, so are church life, so is community service. Then I understand the need for a dialogue about wisdom and prudence and decision-making. But putting it in the context of work-life balance allows one to softly pit work as opposed to one's life. And I think that the implications of that are entirely negative and problematic. And then what they do is they help us to avoid actually getting to the wisdom of the matter, which is having a conversation with someone. I don't have a lot of young women who come to me for advice about their young adult lives, but I have an awful lot of young men who do. And they'll say to me, now I'm 51, my kids are older, I've been married a long time, I built a successful business. And they want to know how I handle dealing with young kids and being a husband and then building a strong career. Those are serious questions. Those are important. If I've already set the table that your work is an enemy to these other things in your life and at odds with them, then I am not able to give the advice that they most need to hear, which is that, guess what? Sometimes you have to miss a kid's soccer game to stay late at work. And sometimes you have to skip a meeting at work to be at a kid's school event. And that there is nothing wrong with either of those things, that they're part of the process of obtaining wisdom and making decisions and doing cost benefits analysis and thinking through things, you know, given the gravity and time and place circumstances and all the stuff. I'm sure you guys know well what I'm talking about. And so what we've basically done now is not allow those conversations of natural tensions, priorities, considerations. Again, I love this word because my late father preached a whole sermon series through the book of Proverbs. I love the idea that we actually think the book of Proverbs was written because we need it. Because that's what we're really talking about, is how to get the wisdom to know about the soccer game here and the work event there and that kind of stuff. But work-life balance is so often done as a way of marginalizing work. And then here's the worst part. It's not even so that we can spend more time with our family. It's most often because people need more time for self-care or yoga or some sort of infantilizing therapeutic nonsense that would make the World War II generation just disgusted.
Yeah, so. That's a huge thing. You know, I got a lot of guys in basements playing video games for sure, living off their parents. That's a challenge. Yeah. We got only so much time left. I want to make sure that I fit in a question. You mentioned your father preaching, and that struck my memory. There's some really interesting and useful, yet also provocative chapters on preaching and work and addressing that topic from the pulpit, but also some predominant, you know, views on work that ministers might have. I'd love if you could comment on just whether it's explicit or implicit, the kinds of views on work that are being taught in churches or maybe even demonstrated.
Yeah, this has been a challenge for me in the aftermath of a book coming out, because I grew up in a small Reformed church where my dad was pastor, and I've spent a lot of time in my adult life in small Reformed churches, and I also have a fair amount of proximity to larger evangelical churches. I have a fair amount of Roman Catholics in my orbit, and I think all these categories have sort of a different challenge with this subject, and so... And not to mention geographies, by the way. You know, I think that you mentioned Keller before. I'm not certain that people having an adequately pro-work priority in their life is as big a challenge for Christians in New York City as it might be in a lot of parts of suburban America and so forth. You know, that's one compliment I paid in New York in the conclusion of my book, that it is largely known as a place of hard drivers and so forth. And so there were different focuses in the ministry that Tim had versus others. But I grew up in an environment where I think Reformed churches often have the theology of work right and not the practice. And then sometimes I think there's a lot of evangelical churches that might have the practice right and not the theology. and not always there either. The evangelical faith and work movement is largely, I think, latent, dualistic, and pietistic. But there can be an awful lot of people that are, and this is a good thing, inconsistent. I say it's a good thing because they might. There's a lot of evangelicals that are doing really well in their careers, working hard. But again, this is where the halftime thing becomes attractive. They're not sure why, and they're not satisfied with it. And so they find themselves looking for a theological cover for why they've been good in their careers. And then that halftime message and some of these other issues become kind of attractive to them. So I do think that there's different challenges throughout the church, but I believe it is the exception, not the rule, when a church is faithfully delivering the theology behind it and the practice. And so I do have a chapter in the book critiquing the kind of message that I think needs to be coming from pulpits to lead the way here. And then I do specifically have a chapter for certain pastors as well. And I, again, wrote it as best I could to be charitable and gracious, but still make the point that I felt needed to be made.
Yeah. No, I like that.
David, and in reading your book, I thought of two people that I'd like you to speak to be an encouragement to them. First, it's the individual who is listening, watching, or reading your book who just feels lost at work. They're struggling to see their purpose. It just is mundane. They feel drudgery, unfulfilling job. I'd like you to help reshape their mindset. That's the first one. The second one is somebody who is at the end of their career, where they're going into the office every day. And rather than looking and saying, I am going to pick up seashells by the seashore, mm-hmm. What are areas that they could lean into, and how, by moving them out of a community, how is that robbing that community from their gifts that God has given them?
Well, let me start with the second one, because I have such strong passions for it, and I appreciate the subtle reference to Piper's unimprovable message there. Because in a lot of ways, what Piper said in that famous talk, what was it now, about 20, almost 25 years ago, it mirrors a lot of the message that I feel of really wanting people to not waste their life and not feel that their life has been wasted. And so when you talk about it in a senior stage of one's life, and you specifically said going to the office, that makes it so much easier, because I'm sensitive to the fact that a lot of people do not go to the office for their work. They're going to a construction site. They're going to pick up a gun and a badge and chase bad guys down the street. You know, there's a certain physicality in their labor that calls the curses out of from Genesis 3 in a much different way than someone like myself, who goes to a very luxurious offices atop a skyscraper in Sixth Avenue most days. And I would I think there's a little more to unpack in the retirement message for those that have age and stage physical restrictions. Those going to an office, I think they may want more margin in later stages of their life. They may be able to provide and contribute at their business in a different way than they did when they were younger. But it's the wholesale removal from useful and productive activity, blue collar or white collar, that I'm resistant to. It is the notion that work was something I did so I wouldn't have to do it anymore. It's the notion, back to the Piper's thing, that now that I have enough shekels, I want to go drive around collecting seashells. And really, you know, it was very benign that he used that as an example to pick on, because he could have said what it is that actually most people do. But I think that was a real life example from Reader's Digest. But how many people have done the same thing with their golf clubs?
Exactly.
Or a sailboat, mm-hmm. or going to the bar.
Yeah.
You know, we need their expertise and experience in our economy, in our society, we suffer from the lack of seniority that we used to have in that dimension of one's life and ability to contribute into the marketplace. So I feel that all at once, my argument about the people in senior years of their life still contributing is focused on them as workers and focused as us as beneficiaries of their work. And that's really why I feel so strongly about that.
Mm. How might we address the people who aren't finding any joy in their work and people that are just suffering and they maybe have a disconnect in their life with what they feel like they're doing day to day for 40 plus hours isn't making a difference and they really don't like it at all?
So the publisher gave me an opportunity after the book had been out a year and they were bringing the book to a re-release in paperback to add a bonus chapter. And so now if anyone is buying the book on Amazon or whatnot, they're getting a bonus chapter that I address this because I really do wish it came up at pretty much 100% of the nearly 200 speeches and interviews I've done since the book came out. And I have a real heart for it, but I have to point out, and I would imagine, you know, people, pastors deal with this a lot, that you're talking about macro principles and people have a question about micro application. And I can speak at a high level about work as a blessing, but Johnny or Jenny or Paul or Peter want to know what it means for them. And their situation could be totally different. Is one of them in a position that doesn't match their skills at all? Is one of them doing something because the families beg them to stay in the family business, but they really want to be doing something different? Is one of them actually really good at their job and they just have a bad attitude? Or is one of them actually doing a job now because they're finishing school, but they have a path to a different path later? Is one of them doing a good work, but at a bad company? And they would rather go to a place where they're doing a similar work, but their input's going to be more valued and respected. There's so many different scenarios that are necessary to unpack to the specifics of what it means to be able to have this joyful attitude. Now, what is universal, apart from Johnny or Jenny or Peter or Paul, what is universal and evergreen is that we do our work without grumbling. And I believe for a lot of people, casting off the romanticism that says at 26 years old, I should be in my dream job and never have a customer talk back to me and never have a boss be rude to me and have all of my coworkers be the greatest people in the world. You know, we can have a more mature and realistic understanding of life in the marketplace, but fundamentally, we have to make sure our own attitude is right first. And it's hard to get our attitude right if we're coming from a place of poor theology about work. So that's the part that I'm trying to serve as a bedrock, is getting this theological understanding right. And it allows people to build an application that will facilitate joy and peace. And yes, there will still be a need for decision-making. There will still be pivots and wisdom decisions along the way. And so that I want it to be encouraging, but of course, in that macro encouragement, I can't speak to every micro application.
Well, that's part of wisdom. You're going to need to apply a knowledge to specific situations. And we do that with prayer and we do that with wise counselors around us. I know we got to get going, but the book today, Full-Time Work and the Meaning of Life, written by our guest today, David L. Bonson, published by Post Hill Press. This is definitely one you're going to want to pick up. I very much enjoyed working through it. I'm going to work through it again. I need to get some daughters-in-law sometime. Well, I'll read it with my own sons, Mark, but we very much appreciate it. But this has been an honor. Thank you very much, David. We appreciate you joining us today and for your very thoughtful responses. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. God bless.
Yes. Take a look online. We'll have information in our episode description to follow up and get the book, as well as to follow up. And you know, if you want to take a look over at the Bonson Group and other interviews that might be available online and David's other books, head over to reformforum.org for information there. We want to thank everybody for listening and for watching. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.